Laban sighed and was silent. "Thou art so shrewd and so false," he said wearily, "and I can make no head against thee, nor should anyone try, since thou wilt but set him in the wrong. But when I look about me, I am as in a dream. All that I see is mine, daughters, children, flocks, and wagons, and beasts, and men. They are mine, but they have passed over into thy hands, I know not how, and thou takest away all before mine eyes, till I am as in a dream. But lo, I am peaceably minded, and I would make a covenant with thee, that we may part in peace, and I may not be consumed all the days of my life on thy account."
"That is good to hear," Jacob answered, "and better than when thou speakest of seemeth and such like complainings. For what thou sayest is after mine own heart. For behold, thou didst beget for me the maid, the mother of my son, in whom thou art become lovely. And it were despicable that the fruit of Laban should be strange in my sight. Only that it might be less hard for thee, have I stolen away and taken mine own with me. But that we should part in friendliness is dear to my heart, that I may then think of thee in a peaceful mind. And I will set up a stone, shall I? For I do it with willing heart. And four of my servants and four of thine shall make a cairn for a meal and a pledge, that we may eat in the sight of God and make a covenant before him. Art thou content?"
"Thou sayest it," quoth Laban, "for truly I see naught else."
Then Jacob went and set up a fine tall stone straight upright, that God might be in their midst. But eight men heaped up the heap of stones for the covenant out of all kinds of rubble and small boulders, and they sat down upon it together, and ate a dish of mutton with the whole fat of the tail in the midst of the dish. But Jacob let Laban eat almost all the tail fat, and only tasted of it. So they ate together in the open air, and made the contract together over the heap between them with eye and hand. Laban swore by his daughters, for he did not know what else. Jacob had to swear by the God of his fathers and the fear of Isaac that he would not mistreat his wives nor take any others but them. The stone heap and the meal were witness. Laban did not concern himself greatly over his daughters, but pitched upon them out of yearning to conclude matters with the man of blessing in order to get some sleep. He spent that night also on the mountain with his daughters. Next morning he embraced them, said a last blessing over them, and turned his face homewards. But Jacob gave a sigh of relief, and another followed of anxiety over new cares. For, saith the proverb, if a man have outrun a lion, he is like to meet a bear. Next came the red man. Benoni. Two women were expectant in Jacob's train, when, after the grievous happenings at Shechem, he went down towards Bethel, and thence onwards in the direction of Kirjath Arba and Isaac's house. Two who have a place in history, that is, for among the slave women one does not distinguish. There might have been several, we cannot tell. Pregnant was Dinah, that unhappy child. She was pregnant from Sychem, the unblessed, and over her fruit there hung a harsh decree, and she rode shrouded from view. And pregnant was Rachel. What joy! But moderate your exultation, remember and be still. For Rachel died. God would have it so. The sweet thief, she who had met Jacob at the fountain, looking with fearless, childlike gaze from among Laban's sheep, she was brought to bed again upon this journey, and survived it not, even as the first time she had hardly done so. Her breath went from her, and she died. The tragedy of Rachel is the tragedy of valor rejected. One has barely courage to enter into Jacob's feelings at this time, when the life of this heart's bride was quenched, and she went hence as a sacrifice to his 12th son. One is reluctant to imagine how his reason was struck down, and the soft self-will of his emotions trodden deep into the dust. "Lord," he cried as he watched her die, "what dost thou?" Well might he so cry. But the perilous thing was, alarming even to contemplate, that he did not surrender his willfulness, his arbitrary indulgence of feeling, when Rachel died, nor bury it with her in that hastily dug grave by the wayside, but as though he would give notice to the Almighty that he might expect to gain nothing by cruelty, he transferred it, in all its arrogant luxuriousness, to Rachel's firstborn, the beautiful 9-year-old lad, Joseph, loving him with a twofold and altogether provocative preference, and thus offering another exposed side for fate to strike at. One wonders whether the feelingful man actually and consciously despised a life of peace and repose, knowingly challenged destiny, and wished for nothing else than to live among alarms and with a sword hanging over him. Such arrogance is obviously an accompaniment to excess of feeling, for such excess presupposes readiness for pain, and everybody knows that nothing is more unthinking than love. The contradiction in nature which here obtains is precisely this, that they are soft souls who choose this life, not formed to bear that which they have drawn upon themselves, whereas they who could have borne it never think of exposing themselves, and thus nothing can happen to them. Rachel had counted 32 years when, in devoted agony, she had given birth to Joseph. 37 when Jacob broke the dusty bolts and took her away. She was 41 when she became again expectant, and in that state must depart from Shechem on their journey. It is I who say it, for with her and among her people it was not the practice to make such reckonings. She would have had to think a long time to be able to say, even approximately, how old she was. It was in general not an important question. In the Eastern world, the chronological awareness of the Occidental is almost unknown. It is much simpler there to leave time and life to themselves and the darkness, not subjecting them to systems of measuring and counting. A man is so little prepared for a question concerning his personal age that the questioner may be surprised by a shoulder shrug and an answer that wavers among whole decades. 40 or 70, perhaps. Jacob, too, was very unclear over his own age, and did not mind it. Certain periods spent in Laban's service were, it is true, precisely reckoned, but others not. Moreover, he did not know and did not care how old he was when he came. As for Rachel's age, the abiding present of their loving companionship prevented him from noting the natural changes which time, whether watched and reckoned or no, must effect in her beautiful and well-favored person, changing the charming young girl into the ripe woman. For him, as usually happens, Rachel was still the bride of the well, who with him had endured the 7 years of waiting while he kissed the impatient tears from her eyes. He saw her with long-sighted eyes, as a blurring of the picture his gaze had first drunk in, the essentials of which could never have been touched by time. The friendly night of the eyes, the short-sighted habit of drawing them together, the two thick nostrils and the little nose, the formation of the corners of the mouth, her touching smile, that very special way in which the lips lay against each other, which was reproduced in the idolized boy, but above all, the archness, gentleness, stout-heartedness that lay in her character, the expression of clear-eyed readiness for life, which even at the well, at the first glance, had made Jacob's heart to swell in his bosom, and which came out so clearly again in the camp at Shechem when she told him of her condition. "May he add children," that was the meaning of the name which, weary almost unto death, she had given to her firstborn. And now that another one was to be added, she had no fear. She gloried in once more enduring all that she had before endured for the sake of her wifely honor and for the increase. And here a strange organic forgetfulness of women probably came to her aid, for many a woman who in childbed swears never to know her husband again, that she may never repeat those pangs, is pregnant again within the year, for the memory of the pains escapes the sex in the strangest way. Jacob, on the other hand, had by no means forgotten the hell he had endured, and revolted from the thought that after 9 years lying fallow, Rachel's body should again be subjected to that paroxysm. For her credit's sake, he rejoiced, also because now the number of his sons would be raised to the temple of the zodiac. That was a fascinating thought. Yet again, it disturbed him to think that a younger successor was making bold to follow the declared favorite. For the youngest always tends to be the favorite, and already he was conscious of something like jealousy for Joseph's sake, that mingled in his parental expectation, and made him from the first not particularly glad over Rachel's state, as though, indeed, a presentiment hovered over him. It was still the time of the winter rains in Kislev when she told him. The tragedy of Dinah was still far in the future. He surrounded the expectant mother as before with all his love and care. He held her head in despair when she was sick, and cried out on his God as he saw her dwindle and grow pale, and only that part of her wax, where the gross and natural selfishness of the fruit displayed its unconscious cruelty. The thing in the womb was bent on growing. Pitilessly and heeding naught else, it drew sap and strength into itself at the expense of her who bore it. It fed upon her, unthinking either for good or for evil. And if it had known how to express its notion of the state of affairs, or even had had one, it would have said that the mother was only a means to its own activity, nothing but the tower of its strength and nourishment. She would be left behind a useless husk or shell after it had issued forth, which was the center and significance of the whole proceeding. Of course, it could not say anything like that, or even think such things, yet unmistakably such was its meaning. And Rachel smiled and assented. Not always is motherhood so utterly synonymous as this with sacrifice. It should not be. But in Rachel, nature showed herself of this mind, had done so clearly in the case of Joseph, though not quite so openly and terrifyingly to Jacob as now. His bitterness against his eldest sons, those refractory Dioscorides for the deed of Shechem, was largely on Rachel's account. It would never have occurred to him to set out upon a journey with that fragile and pregnant woman, in whom now only her fruit was strong. But now these mad youths had forced it upon him with their notions of honor and of revenge. Precisely now, these insensate creatures had had to strike down men in their rage and maim cattle in sheer love of mischief. They were Leah's children, like Dinah, in whose cause they raged. What did they care for the ailing state of their father's true and favored wife, or their father's concern on her account? Never had one such thought crossed their reckless minds. But now it was come to this. They must all away. It was already 8 moons and more since Rachel had told him. 8 counted moons and Rachel moons, while she grew and diminished, while the child in her grew and she declined. The round year had begun in blossom anew. They were in Elul, the 6th month, midsummer heat. It was not a time to travel, but no choice was left. Rachel must mount. He chose an ass, an intelligent beast, so as not to expose her to the rocking motion of the camel. She sat far back on the animal, where the motion was least, and 2 donkey boys led it on pain of a beating if they let it stumble against a stone. So they set out with the flocks. Their goal was Hebron, whither the larger part of the caravan should proceed at once. But for himself, his wives, and a certain retinue, Jacob proposed a brief sojourn at Bethel, where he should find sanctuary against pursuit and attack, and where he would gladly rest once more in memory of that night of exaltation and the dream of the ascending stair. This was Jacob's mistake. He had 2 passions in life, God and Rachel. Here they came in conflict, and yielding to the spiritual, he brought down disaster upon the earthly one. He might have gone straight to Kirjath Arba, reaching it in 4 or 5 days of steady travel. If Rachel had died there, at least she need not have gone hence, helpless and wretched like a beggar by the wayside. But he paused for several days with her at Luz, at Bethel on the hilltop, where once he had slept so poorly and dreamed so high. For now, too, he was in danger and extremity, and was minded to have his head lifted up again from on high and hear the utterance of mighty things. The Gilgal was undisturbed, with the blackish stone in the center. Jacob showed it to his people, and pointed out the spot where he had slept, and been found worthy of his extravagant vision. But the stone which had lifted up his head, and which he had anointed, was no longer there. And this vexed him. He set up another, sprinkling it with oil, and spent the whole day in various sorts of devotions, libations, and burnt offerings, with which he took the most careful pains, for he was minded to make this spot, which he recognized as a place of the presence far beyond what local significance attached to it, worthy and fitting for worship, and to build not only an earthen hearth where nourishment for Yah might ascend in smoke, but also to hew an altar out of the rock that crowned the hilltop, with steps leading up to a platform in which there should be hollowed out a basin for libations, with little troughs for them to run off. That took some trouble, and Jacob gave much time to directing the work. His people looked on and listened to his orders. Likewise, folk came up out of curiosity from the town of Luz, and lying or squatting, filled the free space before the altar, and watched the proceedings of this roving priest and seer with thoughtful faces and murmured exchange of opinions. There was nothing strikingly new in what they saw, though it was clear to them that this dignified stranger was bent on interpreting the usual in an unusual and even irregular sense. For instance, he pointed out the horns at the four corners of his sacrificial table, and told them that they were not moon horns, not the bull horns of Marduk Bel, but the horns of rams. This was a surprise. They discussed it among themselves. When he addressed the Lord as Adonai, they supposed for a long time that he meant the lovely one who had been mangled and had arisen. But later they were convinced that he referred to somebody else. The name of El they did not hear. That he was called Israel was a mistake. That was the name of the man himself, personally, and the name of the sect whose shepherd he was. Then for a while it was thought that he himself was the god of the ram's horns, or gave out so to be. But that was set right later. One might not make a picture of God, for though he had a body, he had no form. He was fire and cloud. Some of them accepted that, others rejected it. In any case, it was plain that the man Jacob's thoughts about his God were highly significant, even though a sort of anxiety or actually pain was visible in his wise and solemn presence. He looked wonderful up there when he slew the kid with his own hand, let the blood run down, and smeared with it the horns which were not moon horns. Likewise, wine and oil were richly poured out before the unknown, and bread brought. The stranger must be rich, a fact which spoke in his favor as well as in his God's. He burnt the best pieces of the kid, the smoke whereof smelt sweet of samim and basamim. From the rest a meal was prepared, and it was partly to be able to partake of this, if also because the wanderer's personality had won them over, that several of the townsfolk declared their readiness to sacrifice to the God of Israel, though only as subsidiary to their own inherited worship. In the course of these proceedings and advances, most of the natives had been bewitched by the incredible beauty of Joseph, the youngest son of Jacob. They kissed their fingertips when he appeared, clapped their hands above their heads, feasted their eyes, and almost burst with laughter when, with ingratiating shamelessness, he called himself the favorite of his parents, on the ground of his mental and bodily charms. Enjoying his childish conceit, with that pedagogic irresponsibility which characterizes our relation to other people's children. Jacob spent in retirement the later hours of this day, preparing himself for the revelations which might be vouchsafed him in the night. And they came to pass, though not with the overwhelming vividness of that early experience. A voice, great, abstract, vague, and elevating, spoke to him of fruitfulness and the future, and of the fleshly bond with Abram, and most impressively of all, of the name which the sleeper had wrested with strength and anguish at Jabbok, and which he forcibly confirmed to him as it were forbidding him his old and original one, and blotting it out, and giving authority to the new. It filled the listener's heart with a stirring sense of new beginnings, as though a cut had been made, and the old fell away, and time and the world stood renewed. So much did all this express itself in his manner next day, that he was avoided of all. In his deep absorption, he seemed to have forgotten Rachel's state, and nobody made bold to remind him, least of all the sufferer herself, who, in her affectionate modesty, subordinated to his musing her own great need of going on. At last, he gave the order. From the Mount of Olives near Jebus, also called Urushalim, where a Hittite man named Putechepa administered the government and took the taxes in the name of the Egyptian Amun, one might have looked down, and very likely did so, upon the little train of tiny figures winding down from Bethel through broad rolling country that lay parched in the summer heat. It passed by Jebus on its left and took its way south towards the house of Lama or Beth-Lama. Jacob might well have wished to turn in at Jebus to inquire of the priests about the sun god Shelim, a local deity here in the west, after whom the town took its second name. For it stirred him to hear talk even about false and foreign deities, and contributed to his inward labors upon the image of the one and only God. But the story of Shechem, and what his sons had done to the garrison and Baset, their captain, might very easily have come to the ears of Amun's deputy, the shepherd Putechepa. It seemed wiser to the traveler to practice discretion. On the other hand, at Beth-Lama, the house of bread, he could discuss with the incense-burners of the Lama the origin of this manifestation of the Arisen and the Nourisher, in whose cult even Abram in his time had shown a friendly interest, as in a possibly related faith. He rejoiced to see the town greeting him from its site. It was late afternoon. The western sun, sinking beneath a bluish wall of storm cloud, sent down broad rays and bands of light across the mountainous landscape, so that the little hill settlement glistened white in its radiance. Dust and stone were kindled by the soft and solemn brightness. It filled Jacob's heart with a proud and pious sense of the divine. On their right, behind a wall of loose stone, ran violet-tinted vineyards, while small fruit orchards filled in the spaces between the rubble on their left. The distant ranges paled to shadow in a sort of translucent glimmering. A very ancient, mostly hollow mulberry tree bent athwart the road, its trunk supported by a pile of stones. They were just passing it when Rachel slipped from her ass in a faint. Hours before, the pains had begun. At first, slight, but she had not liked to disquiet Jacob and interrupt the journey, and had said nothing. Now, on a sudden, her agony was so great, so rending, that it deprived of her senses the frail receptacle of the sturdy fruit. Jacob's tall, splendidly caparisoned dromedary came to its knees unbidden to let its rider dismount. He cried to an old slave, Guta, a woman from beyond the Tigris, learned in women's matters, who had aided many a labor in Laban's house before now. They laid the sufferer under the mulberry tree and dragged up mattresses. Perhaps it was the aromatic herbs they gave her to smell. It may have been fresh pains that brought her round. She promised not to faint again. "I will be alert, and I will labor from now on," she gasped, "for I would hasten and not make the train to tarry, my dear lord. Alas, that it hath come upon me now, so near the goal! But one chooseth not one's time." "It mattereth not, my dove," answered Jacob softly. And involuntarily he murmured an invocation, such as at Naharin one sent up to Ea in time of need. "You have made us. May then illness, swamp fever, ague, and all misfortune be far from us." And the midwife repeated other such sayings, and hung about the sufferer a well-tried charm of her own, in addition to those she already wore. As the pains came on again in fury, she talked to Rachel in her broken Babylonian tongue. "Be consoled, thou fruitful one, and endure the rage of the attack, for thou shalt have this son likewise to the other one, So much in my wisdom I can see, and thine eye shall not run out ere thou beholdest him, for the child is quick indeed.